From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Governor DeSantis signs the SAVE Act into law, saying it will discourage any kind of chicanery when it comes to the state's elections.
You do it when you think you know you can get away with it. And so we put the kibosh on that.
Also this week, we'll dive a bit deeper into the SAVE Act legislation and ask the big money question, was it really something that was critically needed?
And all the evidence shows that only eligible American citizens are voting in our elections.
We'll also wonder what happened to Florida's big anti-vaccine push. We'll check out the panic buttons teachers are wearing, and after half a century, we'll blast off for a trip around the moon. I'm Tom Flanagan. On air and online, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Floridians could soon have to show proof of citizenship before they can register to vote. A coalition of voting rights organizations says that's unconstitutional. They're taking the argument to court, as we hear from Tristan Wood.
The newly signed law requires proof that someone is a legal resident, like a birth certificate or passport, before they can register to vote. It also requires voters to bring an official state ID to the polls. Fort Pierce Republican Senator Erin Grawl sponsored the bill in her chamber.
We have state systems, we have real IDs that there is credibility and fidelity in, and we should be able to count on those, not something that's not secure.
It's the latest in a host of state election law changes passed since 2020. During the bill signing, Governor Ron DeSantis applauded that previous work.
If people know there's going to be accountability, then doing any shenanigans, it's just not worth it. Why would you want to do it and end up with a significant penalty? You do it when you think you know you can get away with it. And so we put the kibosh on that.
Several groups, including the League of Women Voters of Florida, Florida Immigrant Coalition, and Florida Rising, filed a suit against the measure almost immediately after DeSantis signed it. They argue it violates the First and 14th Amendment. And Adriana Rivera, a spokesperson with the Florida Immigrant Coalition, worries the new requirements will disenfranchise people who can legally vote.
There's millions of Floridians that don't currently have a passport. Passports are pricey, so they're going to, you know, there's going to be a barrier of entry there because of the cost.
Rivera says Florida's elections are secure, and she thinks there's no need to make voter registration more difficult.
Governor DeSantis was, you know, parading around in the last election how Florida was like the most secure, one of the most secure elections in the whole country. So why is this piece of legislation even needed? They just want to disenfranchise people. They're just looking for an excuse to do it.
During the bill signing, Grawl, the bill sponsor, pushed back on criticism that voter fraud isn't an issue.
It absolutely is happening. And we have the Office of Election Crimes and Security who puts together a report. And in that report outlines the times that people have admitted illegal aliens have admitted to voting in our elections. They have admitted to it.
The bill is modeled after the Save America Act, which the Trump administration is currently pushing at the federal level. I'm Tristan Wood.
And as we just heard from Tristan Wood, as soon as Governor Ron DeSantis signed that SAVE Act legislation this week, litigation was filed against it. On WGCU's Southwest Florida In Focus, Jennifer Crawford recently spoke with Andrew Garber of the Brennan Center for Justice to further explain Florida's SAVE Act.
We are hearing a lot about this SAVE Act, both on the state level and on the federal level. Can you explain for our audience, what is the SAVE Act?
The SAVE Act is a bill before Congress that would do a few different things that would be really harmful for our elections nationwide. Perhaps among those is that it would require all Americans to present a passport, birth certificate, or similar document to be able to register to vote. Now, there are 21 million Americans who don't have ready access to these documents. This is a policy that would significantly impact vast swaths of the electorate in the country. There's no evidence that anyone but Americans are voting, American citizens are voting in our elections. And so this bill would really be a voter suppression measure that would make it a lot harder for a lot of people to vote while not actually providing any additional election security. Florida has passed its own version of the SAVE Act in recent days that, again, would require a lot of its citizens to have to present something like a passport or birth certificate to be able to register to vote. And that's going to fall really hard on a lot of people in Florida.
Is the SAVE Act that was recently passed by Governor Ron DeSantis and signed into law this week, is that very similar or the same as to what is being done on the federal level?
There are a lot of similarities, but there are some key differences. The federal bill would require everyone, every time they register or every time they change their registration, to affirmatively present the passport, birth certificate, or similar document. The Florida bill adds a wrinkle to that. It directs the state to create a sort of citizenship verification system. So whenever you submit a voter registration form, they will check that against some the Department of Motor Vehicles records. If the Department of Motor Vehicles says that you're a citizen, you don't have to do anything further. But for voters where they're not verified, they will then have to present the passport or birth certificate or something like that. This is significant. DMV records can be out of date. People may go there to get a license before they become a citizen, and that's not updated in the system. These records sometimes are, you know, aren't always the most up to date. It's really complicated to get these systems to talk to each other. So it's a really big burden for officials in the state to figure this out. And again, this is going to have particularly harsh impacts on certain members of the community in Florida, including older voters, people in rural communities who may be less likely to have a driver's license.
Do you feel that this is really a federal attack on the right to vote?
The SAVE Act is part of a widespread attack we've seen in the last few years on the right to vote. To be clear, our elections are very safe and very secure. Everything we've seen, every study, every investigation has confirmed that there is no widespread voter fraud. To give you an example, the state of Utah recently did a big investigation. It ran its voter rolls through this federal database to find any non-citizens on there. There's about 1.7 million registered voters in Utah, and they found one non-citizen on their rolls. This is an extraordinarily rare problem. It's already illegal for non-citizens to vote or register to vote in our elections. That's true at the federal level. That's true in every state. And all the evidence shows that only eligible American citizens are voting in our elections.
The SAVE Act will face potential lawsuits. What is the likelihood that the law remains in its current form?
It's always difficult to prognosticate about what will happen in a given lawsuit. I definitely believe there are significant legal issues with it. Again, we talked about how it places a very significant burden on the right to vote. Under our Constitution, states may not place what's called an undue burden on the right to vote, which means if they're going to put up hurdles, if they're going to make voters jump through hoops to be able to cast their ballot, there has to be a proportionate reason why the state is doing that. And when this new law seems to not rely on any need for election security, but is putting up big new hurdles, that's something that I think raises a lot of red flags.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us today about this SAVE Act?
The SAVE Act and similar legislation that's making it harder for Americans to vote are often rooted in efforts to promote falsehoods about our elections. The truth is our elections are safe and secure. But the other truth is there are 21 million Americans without ready access to a passport or birth certificate. So when these falsehoods are translated into policy, it's the American citizens trying just to exercise their right to vote, to be part of their community, that suffer the effects.
That was Andrew Garber of the Brennan Center for Justice with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. Coming up on Capitol Report, what happened to the anti-vaccine push in Florida?
Very strange. I think they were probably banking on the legislature passing a bill.
It seems the battle against cancer works better when patients have a whole team of doctors fighting in their corner.
Was the sharing of knowledge and the fluidity where it goes back and forth between my providers here and there that works out so well.
And after half a century, astronauts blast off from Florida and head for the moon.
I think after Artemis II, you're going to have more kids that are going to dress up as astronauts for Halloween.
Florida was poised to become the first state in the nation to make vaccines totally optional, but the plan got watered down in this year's legislative session. Even that version, a medical freedom bill, failed to advance. WUSF's Carrie Sheridan reports on what happened to the anti-vaccine push and what may be next.
It came as a sweeping proclamation in September by Florida Surgeon General Joseph Latipo. He said the Department of Health, with the support of Governor Ron DeSantis,
is going to be working to end all vaccine mandates in Florida law. All of them.
To prevent the spread of infectious disease, by law, children have to get certain shots to go to daycares or schools. But to Latipo,
every last one of them is wrong and drips with disdain and slavery.
The Department of Health took a first step by trying to change rules on four vaccines. These require two shots against meningitis, one against chickenpox, and another to prevent hepatitis B. They held a public workshop in December in Panama City. Public comment went on for hours.
I've seen kids with polio. I've seen blind kids. I've seen kids die before they're even 10 years old. It's heartbreaking.
This is about freedom. The default setting should be freedom, not these corporate chemical vaccine injections.
To change rules, it could be simple, but the health department still has to follow certain steps. They have to show what it would cost to make the change and file paperwork within 180 days. Simone Chris is a civil rights attorney with Southern Legal Counsel. She says it's been more than 6 months and none of that has happened.
Nor have they responded to any of the requests for information about the impact on, you know, human lives and health and safety and all of that. So it's very strange. I think they were probably banking on the legislature passing a bill.
Asked for comment, the Florida Department of Health said only it is currently in the rulemaking process. Fast forward a couple of months, and a bill did appear in the Florida Senate. It didn't end vaccine mandates, but added another way to opt out. Florida already allows religious or medical exemptions. The bill would let people say it's against their personal beliefs. Democrats lined up against it. Here's Democratic Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith.
It's currently very easy to opt out for religious reasons from school immunizations. Why is this bill necessary given that context? Is your bill just about giving people more options to ignore school immunizations, or is it intended to solve a public health problem?
Opposition also came from some on the right. Republican Senator Gail Harrell brought up the measles outbreak.
I truly believe that this is a dangerous bill, and I cannot vote for it.
In the end, the Senate passed the bill, but a House version never advanced, and the bill died. Maya Hahn leads the Florida chapter of Children's Health Defense, a national nonprofit that was founded by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and is critical of vaccines.
We were disappointed that we did not get a bill that was to eliminate all vaccine mandates here in Florida. Instead, we got a bill that did a few things that we liked.
She still holds out hope that something could pop up in a special legislative session on the budget, which starts this month. But nothing's for sure.
If everything is dead, I can say that this year was a very big disappointment. Very big.
Jennifer Takagishi is vice chair of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Her group is against any change to vaccine mandates.
There was a lot of lobbying, frankly, on both sides.
And the Senate debate, she says,
it felt very one-sided in that as a legislator, you should be representing the majority of your constituents. And instead, they're siding with a small minority.
A variety of polls show broad support for vaccines on the order of 8 in 10 people, largely across party lines. An Associated Press analysis found at least 350 anti-vaccine bills were introduced nationwide last year. Most haven't passed. Barbara Lowe Fisher is president of the National Vaccine Information Center and has been working to end mandates since 1982. She says ever since the COVID pandemic,
there are many more people now who have skepticism about the wisdom of public health policy and law. And I don't think that that's going to disappear. I think it's going to grow.
Many agree the fight is far from over in Florida, where its most powerful advocate, Governor Ron DeSantis, is in his final year. It could be the last for Surgeon General Joseph Latipo, too. I'm Carrie Sheridan in Sarasota.
Cancer is a leading health concern in Florida, with the state holding the second highest cancer burden in the United States. The Florida Cancer Data System estimates that up to 145,000 Floridians are diagnosed with some form of cancer every year. More than 60% of those cases are diagnosed in people age 65 and older. WGCU's Carrie Barber walks us through the search for a second opinion from more than 1,000 miles away.
Florida saw at least 170,000 new cases of cancer last year, according to the American Cancer Society. That's higher than the national average based on the state's population. Kimran Rathmel, CEO of the James Cancer Institute at Ohio State University, explains what accounts for Florida's high rates.
Our chances for having cancer increase as we age, and Florida has a disproportionately older population.
The James Cancer Institute, or the JAMES, may be able to help. Dr. Rathmel recommends patients should always get a second opinion, and thanks to advances in technology, that opinion may be from a doctor in Columbus, Ohio.
First of all, patients need to know that it is okay to ask for second opinions. This is your life that you're dealing with, and you should have the full confidence of your team. It is also very much okay to expect that those doctors are both on your team, and that actually happens more than people probably realize. I think there's sort of a sense that there will be some animosity or competition. There usually is not, and there shouldn't be.
Paul Perry of Naples received this style of treatment for his multiple myeloma.
The great thing is I have a local oncologist who's excellent, have an oncologist at Ohio State who's excellent. The two of them share patients. We go back and forth. Because of the myeloma, 3 years ago I had a kidney transplant because my kidney had failed. And right there, because my myeloma flared up, my local myeloma doctor immediately jumps in. The myeloma is all immediately under control again. But it was the sharing of knowledge and the fluidity where it goes back and forth between my providers here and there that works out so well.
Dr. Rathmel, who until recently was head of the National Cancer Institute, hopes to expand this way of working.
One of the things that we are really trying to be champions of is a model of care that's exactly like I'll describe, having an expert, myeloma team that's, you know, deep in the latest and greatest of myeloma, but also having a generalist oncologist where you live who can be there for the day-to-day. And that they're not in at all competition with each other. You need both. Both are really vital to an individual patient's success.
The ideal, she says, is to get patients the right care at the right place at the right time. She says that mortality from cancer has decreased 30% in the last 30 years, thanks in large part to advances like this and medical research.
Clinical research is really the standard of care today in cancer. And that's not saying that, boy, we don't know what we're doing, so we have to do a trial. It's actually saying that we're at a place where everything has an opportunity to be better today, whether it's moving from curable but toxic to curable and more tolerable, or learning how we take knowledge about cure and move it into prevention.
She says this promises to help lower the mortality rate even more in coming years.
The future for early detection and managing cancer proactively is really bright and very exciting.
I'm Carrie Barber in Naples.
Florida law requires school staff to wear panic buttons. The button generated 54,000 alerts last year. A new report tells us how often and why staff are relying on the tech. WLRN's Natalie LaRoche-Pietri reports.
A new report shows that 44% of alerts were student behavior related. Only 1% was because of suspicious behavior. Broward School Board member Lori Alhadef spearheaded the law. Her daughter was killed in the Parkland school shooting.
Here in Broward County Public Schools, the panic button is used around 900 times per month, but it's the teachers, they feel safer. The students feel safer.
The report also says 40% of alerts came from rooms. Here's Stacy Meyer, an executive at Centegix. It made the crisis alert buttons and compiled the report.
But when 60% of the alerts are actually happening on a playground, on an athletic field, in an auditorium, And a lot happens in the hallways, and they're passing and they're moving. And that is a high time when behavior issues arise and some physical altercations can break out.
The alert system is used by 53% of Florida public schools. Broward and Palm Beach County school districts have adopted it, and Miami-Dade County is in the pilot phase. I'm Natalie LaRoche-Pietri in Miami.
The construction industry has been male-dominated for generations. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says women make up only 11% of the construction workforce. But that's changing in Fort Myers. WGCU's Kate Cronin reports on new programs introducing women to the industry.
For some, the construction industry has felt like a man's game. With women only making up 11% of the workforce, they are more likely to experience discrimination, harassment, and gender bias, according to the Institute for Women's Policy Research. But at one construction site in Fort Myers, women are blazing a new trail. The new Lee Health Fort Myers building will be completed in 2028, thanks to senior project manager Charisse Travis. With over 20 years of experience, she's seen the industry shift.
I always tell people I've been stubborn enough to stick around because my goal and desire has always been to make sure that my presence allows other women to see that it is an acceptable and a fun career. So I've watched the trajectory over the last 24 years and I've seen the growth. And it honestly brings me extreme joy to see the progression of the industry in the past 24 years. So will I say I was intimidated initially? Probably a little bit, but I'm, you know, a short girl from Texas who's very stubborn.
Some of the biggest challenges women face in a male-dominated industry are due to isolation and lack of mentorship. One of the greatest tools Skanska Construction offers is its women's network. The program connects newer employees with mentors and resources to help them succeed. Tori Gabriel is a member and works on-site as assistant superintendent.
I was kind of surprised when I joined architecture school to see that our year was about 50-50 women and men. And it was really inspiring to see that the industry is starting to move forward and there's more women joining and realizing that this is an option for us. And coming in and doing internships and joining with a company like Skanska, we have a core value of better together with a bunch of support from both male and female counterparts, both higher in seniority and entry level. So it just continues to expand, and I think it's really inspirational.
And the number of women in construction continues to grow, jumping by 70% from 2017 to 2022, according to the IWPR. Professionals like assistant project manager Annika Rostent attribute the rise to better understanding of the unique skills women offer.
To me, 11% feels like a great improvement compared to how it was historically. And it just goes to show that the standard is really changing and evolving, and the industry has become way more welcoming to women. And you know, women are very collaborative and we have a lot to offer. We have great interpersonal skills, I would say, and communication is probably the top skill that you need to work in construction management. So I would say that women have a lot to contribute, and although we make up a small percentage, that's growing every day.
Women only gained the right to work without discrimination by sex 50 years ago, thanks to the Civil Rights Act. But women still make up a fraction of leadership positions and average lower wages. Skanska Construction is setting an example of what women can achieve in encouraging more women to consider a career in the industry.
I say call me. We're hiring. This is a fun career to be in. There's so much to learn, so much to do, lots of great opportunities. I say do it. You know, I think everyone, not just women alone, need to understand there's other options outside of college, but I would love to have a woman, you know, join our team or just the construction industry as a whole, because we do have a lot to give, right? And we are valued and we are supported. So I say call me.
I'm Kate Cronin.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, we have a literally uplifting story that started this week and is continuing over the weekend. After more than 50 years, NASA is back in the business of sending astronauts to the moon on its own rocket. The Artemis II crew is on its way to the moon after launching Wednesday evening from the Kennedy Space Center. The mission is historic and critical for the future of NASA's lunar ambitions. Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne filed this report shortly after the launch.
4, 3, 2, 1, booster ignition, and liftoff. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
NASA's massive SLS rocket roared to life at 6:35, its twin solid rocket boosters and four engines cracking the air, lifting the Orion capsule and four astronauts into space under a smoky trail into a clear blue Florida sky. It was a smooth countdown, though teams did investigate a couple of problems before the launch. Those problems were not the same as what plagued the rocket in earlier tests, like leaking hydrogen fuel and communications problems. Before liftoff, Launch Director Charlie Blackwell Thompson gave the final go for launch.
Reed, Victor, Christina, and Jeremy, on this historic mission, you take with you the heart of this Artemis team, the daring spirit of the American people, and our partners across the globe, and the hopes and dreams of a new generation. Good luck. Godspeed, Artemis II. Let's go.
And they did just that. So far, NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman is considering the mission a success.
NASA astronauts Commander Reid Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, mission specialist Christina Koch, and Canadian Space Agency mission specialist Jeremy Hansen are safe, they're secure, and they're in great spirits. We will continue to monitor their health and the status as we move into the next phase of the Artemis II mission.
The mission is a critical test of the Orion spacecraft, named Integrity, flying with a crew of four for the first time ever. So far, mission pilot Victor Glover took manual control of the spacecraft while in Earth orbit, testing its maneuverability for future dockings with a lunar lander while in orbit. They want to see if it flies the way it was designed, and
we also want to give, you know, qualitative and quantitative feedback to the ground team, so letting them know what it feels like now that we can hear and feel the thrusters, and to just understand the human experience.
These tests are happening while the spacecraft is circling the Earth. If the vehicle systems, things like temperature and oxygen controls, check out, the crew will get the go-ahead to fire their engines and head deeper into space, putting them on a path to slingshot around the moon. The mission is the start of a new chapter of lunar exploration. Just last week, Isaacman drastically changed the Artemis program. He scrapped plans for a lunar orbital station, instead calling for a science base on the surface of the moon. And he wants to fly Artemis missions more frequently. The last one was in 2022. For Republican Congressman and Chairman of the Space and Aeronautics Subcommittee, Mike Haradopoulos, success is not only good for NASA, but for Florida's Space Coast.
This is a big test for the USA, and I think that if we can find success, like I highly anticipate, we're going to see this space industry grow more. And it's not just, again, a national exploration. It is a growing part of our economy.
For Isaacman, he hopes the launch of Artemis II goes beyond Florida's space coast and inspires people across the country.
I think after Artemis II, you're going to have more kids that are going to dress up as astronauts for Halloween. We want to inspire and create interest in the next generation to grow up and contribute to this endeavor.
And Isaacman might be one step closer to that wish. Over 14 million people tuned into NASA's live broadcast on YouTube to watch this new chapter of space exploration unfold here on Florida's Space Coast. I'm Brendan Byrne at the Kennedy Space Center.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jennifer Crawford, Carrie Barber, Natalie LaRoche-Pietri, Kate Cronin, Kerry Sheridan, and Brendan Byrne. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.